Hey everyone, welcome to my podcast, Insights by Ben Siegel. The name of the podcast was based on the idea and notion that every episode there will have one or two nuggets of knowledge from our guests. I'm Ben Siegel, Managing Director at Private Wealth at UBS Financial Services. Our team, Connor Siegel Partners, based in New York City, Miami, and Boston. After the podcast, I can be reached at benjamin.siegel@ubs.com. Today's special guest is John Regas, founder of Science Capital and master of the universe in water infrastructure investing. A big welcome, John. John, is water safe?
First of all, Ben, thank you very much for having me as your guest here. It is my pleasure to be here with you. As it relates to water being safe, water is different everywhere. So the answer is depends where you're taking the water from. Water is a chemical, just like any other commodity. And so if you're in a place where the water is clean, the water is clean. If you're in a place where the water is polluted, the water is not safe. Can we make it safe? More or less, yes. But it depends on having appropriate infrastructure. It depends on having appropriate processes, having the resources, and to be able to treat the water to make it safe. Generally speaking, in the United States, the United States is not in the top 10 clean water countries. The Yale University does an annual rating, and the latest rating gave the United States an 87.2, which is not great, okay, for a country, but an advanced country. But there's only 10 countries that have 100 rating, and then everybody's below that, and. But it's a little bit unfair because the United States is not just a country, it's a continent. So you're looking at a very vast space, and to have perfect water everywhere, it's a bit of a big ask.
Right, but we're able to recycle some water to make it better.
I hate to say that the United States is at the low end of the recycling. Recycling of what, first of all, you have to there are two types of recycling. Recycling water that has been used and you want to recycle it for a reuse in the same use that you are using it for. And there is recycling water for return to the environment, treating it for return to the environment. And so the highest accomplishment in terms of recycling water is in Singapore. They recycle 100% of all their water. Okay, so all their water is recycled. I don't want to estrange your guests, but the way they got this, first of all, they have the need. So necessity is the mother of invention. What they do is they recycle all water that's coming out of the toilets. So they have this program called From Poop to Tap. Okay, and society has accepted it because they have to. That's Singapore. Okay, it's a unique situation. It's a city state. It's not vast real estate, so you can actually do it because you control the whole system. Then you have Israel. They're about 75% recycling water, which is very high for a country. European countries are in the 30s. United States is at 10%. So we have ways to go to recycle water.
Right. And is that why bottled water is so popular?
Well, bottled water is popular because of perception that it's cleaner. And in some ways, it can be cleaner than tap water if the tap water is not properly treated and if the system out of which it is coming is not clean. So, for example, in New York, we have very good tap water, okay? But in some other places, the water is not very good. So bottled water would be better. Of course, now there is a new angle, as there's always is in when we deal with the environment, and that is the PFAS. So bottled water has microparticles, plastic microparticles, that goes straight into your body. They last for a long time. They're not biodegradable, and they can even go into your brain. So PFAS is one of the things that we are beginning to treat now. It's been legislated in the United States that over the next 10 years, PFAS, the microplastics, are going to be treated at every level.
Wow, that must have a big impact on children.
It does.
So, I mean, to me, water is one of the most fascinating topics because it involves almost everything in life. And One of our global macro themes here is we believe in the next 5 to 10 years, AI is going to be very big, electrification of the United States, and wealth and wellness and health because of the aging of the population. But how does water cut across all those topics?
So water cuts across all human activity. And I'll come to the three subjects that you mentioned. But to begin with, to frame it, first of all, agriculture. 70% of water is used in agriculture. With no water, no food. That's number one. Number two is the universal solvent. Okay, it's used in all manufacturing. Okay, you need water. So without water, there's no manufacturing. Wealth and sanitation. Okay, sorry, health and sanitation. Okay, without water, you cannot have proper sanitation. Forget wellness. Okay, you have to remove waterborne disease first, which is a problem in the U.S. Okay, and then you have it used in mining. You have it used in. You mentioned AI. It's hugely, hugely important in AI, simply because for AI you need data centers, and data centers need to be cooled. And everybody has tried everything, but at the end of the day, the only real way to cool data centers is water. So anywhere where you see a new data center, like the new ones that, for example, Meta is building with, it's funny, they have Greek names, Hyperion and Prometheus, and they're very momentous, very important, momentous names. One of them, Prometheus, is supposed to be the size of 3/4 of Manhattan. So we're talking a huge, huge establishment. Well, that is going to consume incredible amounts of water. Already with the data centers that we have, we see that the water table in the locations where the data centers are located is always depleted, and the water quality is worse because you cannot extract the chemicals that are used for cooling. Okay, so that is going to accelerate massively, and water is going to be extremely important for data centers. Now, as it relates to electrification, most people may not remember this, but the United States won World War II. The electricity that was used to power the factories that won World War II was all from hydro. And that was the time that they were building dams, the biggest dam being the Hoover Dam in 1929, because after the financial crisis, the government needed shovel-ready jobs. And there are no more shovel-ready jobs than building dams. And they built all the dams, about 80,000 dams that we have in the U.S., where the vast majority were built at that time. And that created the electricity capacity that eventually won the war and created the post-World War II boom. So for electrification, you massively, massively need water. There's no way around it. And of course, hydro is clean energy. Okay. As it relates to wellness, the way that you are considering wellness, which is the older people, aging, and so on and so forth, it's hugely important. I'll give you a nice historical example. So the first time, obviously you've heard of in the ancient times of different springs where people would go because the water had the minerals, and they would go there to heal themselves or relax and so on and so forth. There's the famous one in Loutraki, in which was the resort of the Southampton of the Athenians, the ancient Athenians. Then in Rome, the Romans built the aqueducts to bring water into the city, of Rome.
That aqueduct is so amazing. I can't even fathom how intelligent they were to think of all.
And what's even more amazing is, A, you source it from 200 kilometers away, okay, A. B, you have to get the incline at which the water is coming down the slope perfect, because if you do it too steep, well, then, of course, you don't have enough height, okay? But also, it rushes down. So you have to get it absolutely perfect over tens of kilometers to actually make the water come down at the pace that you want it to come, and not to have a river flowing down with a big current. And the other thing, of course, that most people don't realize is that, I don't know if you know why there are two floors on the aqueducts or three floors.
No, I didn't.
That's because people would steal it for agriculture. So you wanted the water to be up there so people cannot touch it. But coming back to wellness, okay, the water was used for baths. in Rome, and then in Constantinople, and so where they have even bigger ones, and so on and so forth. They had the whole complex, and so water and wellness are intertwined in a way that inextricable.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you actually got into the water infrastructure business, and what actually do you do in that business?
Yeah, so we are a private equity firm in essence. We started over 30 years ago, we've always looked for deep value investments, cyclical investments, and we've made many of those in many industries. At one time, we started looking at the real assets. And in real assets, so that could be real estate, but there's a lot of people doing that. The first one that we did was in aviation. And then we did other stuff like gas storage and colored diamonds, and you name it. Anything that...
I like diamonds.
Especially colored ones are very nice. Anything that is esoteric, because if it's esoteric, fewer people know about it. And if you can find the value add in the esoteric and you can execute on the value add, then the moat protecting your business is very strong. So one of the sectors that we started looking at was the water sector. And the reason for that is that we realized that there are no private equity firms in the water sector.
In pure water.
In pure water, yeah. But it's fast. The water sector is vast because you have water infrastructure everywhere. The water infrastructure in the U.S. is actually our biggest infrastructure between the dams and the pipes and the treatment facilities and so on and so forth. In the aggregate, it's the biggest. So we looked at that and we saw a sector that at first blush, other than size, which is obvious, we saw a sector that first of all, the headlines are sensational, right? Okay, so you have drought or you have flood, or you have war, or you have anything with water. Okay, then you go beyond the sensational, and you find a sector that again is if there was one word to characterize it, would be fragmentation, and the fragmentation is multi-layered. So you have fragmentation, first of all, geographic. Some places have water, some places don't have water. So whatever you decide to do in St. Louis, Missouri, next to the Mississippi River, is completely different than what you're going to do in Phoenix, Arizona. The second fragmentation is legal. So in the United States, water is considered intrastate commerce. So that means the states have control over the laws over water. So every state has different laws. Okay. So to make it simple, okay, in some states, you're allowed to put a tank on top of your building, collect the water from the rain, and that's yours. In some other states, it belongs to the state. In some of the states that it belongs to the state, doesn't give you guidelines how to actually provide it to the state, how to convey it to the state. So it's all over the place, and it's historic in nature. The eastern United States have mostly English-based laws, riparian in nature. So that's the river coming down, and we both have farms or homesteads on the side of the river. So we can extract from the river what we can reasonably be expected to use. Okay, so that's the riparian laws. Then in on the western side of the United States, beyond the Mississippi, remember, go west, young man, and so on and so forth, and stake your ground. Okay, so what would they tell you? Stake your ground. But if you stake your ground, then you get the water in that ground as well, because there's no use to having agriculture or grazing or whatever if you don't have water. So what they didn't tell you is that the water that you own out there is only for the original use primarily, okay? So that creates huge complications as to what the how the water can be used and so on and so forth. So fragmentation again in law. Then you have regulations. So the United States, interestingly, is the only OECD country that does not have a central regulator for water. Okay, everybody else has. The regulation is done by the public services commissions of the states. Okay, so again, they apply the rules differently. They have different preferences, different political dispositions, and so on and so forth.
And they have, what is it, 33,000 water utilities?
There are 88,000 utilities.
Wow.
Between the freshwater and the wastewater. And the public services commissions regulate those utilities. But then the only thing that you have that's federal is the EPA. It's a federal agency. But the EPA regulates for quality of water, okay, not for service or price and what have you. So again, different practices. And then we go to the corporate fragmentation that you mentioned. There are 88,000 utilities. There's no other country with 88,000 utilities.
Not just Europe, like in general, what country well, they
it,
would have.
It depends. It depends how you calculate. But you look at a country like Ireland, there is one. Okay? You look at a country like France,
right.
Okay, there are three holding company utilities, but there are some municipalities that have their own. So technically, you could say those are different systems. But basically, very concentrated. And then you have corporate fragmentation. The water sector is actually being a very mature sector because it's ancient, obviously. It's one of the few, probably the only one, that has not been consolidated in massively. In most sectors in the U.S., the top three or four or five companies own 85% market share, and the, all the small guys are 15%. Here, the top three or four companies in every water subsector may have, I don't know, 12 to 15% market share. And the middle-sized small companies, the moms and pops, owner-operators, people who cannot meet regulatory standards, they own the 85%. Okay, so it's huge fragmentation. So how do we get into it? We saw that. We saw this fragmentation. And we said, okay, if we can bring a private equity skill set, which is organizational primarily, and institutional capital into this sector, we can benefit because we can exploit all the different opportunities that it offers.
Right. And so in your water business, is it different things that you do? You own the water rights, I mean, the actual water, and you clean it and deliver it to homes, but you also own tech companies around it, sensors and other things. How's your business broken up?
So, after a lot of study, we have decided not to own the water. Because the water is a public good and it better remain in public hands. We own the businesses that operate in the hydro-commerce cycle. So hydro-commerce cycle means the cycle where you take water from the water table, from a river, from a lake, you treat it for use, you store it if need be, then you use it as appropriate, and everybody's a user, as we were saying before, from residences to factories to military bases, hospitals, everybody. Then you treat it either for reuse on site or elsewhere, or you treat it for return to the environment. So in that respect, it's actually 100% cyclical. The water doesn't get lost. People think that if they keep the... It goes back to where it came from. The question is, in what quality does it go back to where it came from?
Right.
It has to be cleaned up to go back to the environment or for reuse. So we operate the company. We want to be invested in companies that are in the hydro-commerce cycle. So in that respect, we invest in utilities. We invest in the transmission distribution system, which is basically pipelines, storage tanks, thermal tanks, you name it. Pipeline system, by the way, in the United States, nobody knows how big it is. It's about 1.3 to 1.6 million miles, okay? You can go to the moon and back three times with that, okay? That's how big it is. And then we invest in companies that do treatment, all types of treatment. And we invest in companies that provide elements of digital infrastructure to the water sector, because technology adoption is now a big theme in the water sector, and we're interested in that.
Yeah, what is digital infrastructure?
It can be anything. So it can be a smart meter, okay? So in the United States, electric smart meter penetration, you mentioned electrification, is close to 90%, between 85 and 90%. And water smart meter penetration, okay, is less than 20%, 22%. Nobody knows the exact number, but it's down there. Now, what that means is that if you are a utility, okay, and you have two clients, you and me,
yeah,
and your house has a pool and my house doesn't have a pool, if they don't have a smart meter, we may be getting the same invoice, the same bill. So there are all kinds of dimensions of inequity, social inequity, and so on and so forth in not having smart meters. So smart meters is something that's coming into the U.S. now. There are companies that are putting it in, and municipalities are very interested. And the interesting thing is that when a municipality introduces smart meters into their network, they actually make more money because they can control better where the water goes. You have to remember that in the average loss of water of utilities globally, okay, is 30%. So 30% of all water is unaccounted for. It either is through leaks in pipes or misused or stolen or whatever have you. Okay. So if you have smart meters, you can actually control that because you can see the flow of water from spot to spot to spot. Again, no, and if you're losing water, you know where you're losing them. So that's just one example. There's many other examples of sensors, for example, because you know the other thing with water is that you can measure everything about water. You can measure the direction that it flows, the speed at which it flows, the chemical composition, the temperature, you name it, the what other chemicals it has inside, and so on and so forth. So. And that's why, by the way, it's a prime candidate for AI, because if someone can master that data and extract meaningful insights from that data, then you can improve a lot of different things, even how floods are handled, which floods, as you know, is one of the biggest insurance problems in the United States. Some years is 30% of all payouts are to damage from floods.
So, you know, it's very interesting. Everybody always wants to live by the water. Especially at the beach or a lake. But how much actual fresh water is there in the world and where is it?
So, okay, so starting at the beginning, okay, 97% of all the water in the world, 97% of the water is in the oceans, okay? So it's saline, you can't drink it, okay? 3% is the water that is not salty, okay? That 3% is from the Himalayas all the way up, okay, all the way into ancient aqueducts, okay, or aquifers that may be at the bottom of the earth, okay? So of that 3%, okay, we use roughly 1% to 1.5% for use. And this is humanity in its entirety.
That's unbelievable.
The 8 to 10 billion people, going to 10, okay, we're using only that water.
Oh, that's incredible.
That's why one of the big prizes in water technology, which has not been, and whoever solves that, they will be very, very wealthy, is if at some point someone devises a methodology for desalination, okay, that is actually energy efficient. Because right now you have desalination, it's possible, technologically proven, and it's done in some places, done on a large scale, like, for example, the Middle East. But it's subsidized. It's subsidized with cheap energy costs. If you have market energy costs, it's not viable in the marketplace. So if someone solves that, that's the big prize.
Right.
That's way off, though.
And how much of a delta is it to figure out? Like, is the cost versus regular water that we have here versus desalination? Is it a big spread?
Yeah, it's a big spread. It's a big spread.
Understood. So you've had an illustrious career. You've been in many, many businesses. You're in a high-end luxury brand. And so what do you attribute to your success? Because you've made success in many different areas. I mean, right now you're focused on water, but it's those qualities, I think, you know, we'd like to understand how you got there.
Well, okay. So... in my case, I was and I continue to be extremely curious intellectually. So I like the challenge of a new play. And also, when you're looking at deep value assets that are overseen and other people have not realized what the value is and so on and so forth, you have to be intellectually curious. You have to go and investigate it yourself. No one is going to bring it to you. But look, success is, the rules are very simple. First of all, 10,000 hours of everything, okay? Every genius has spent an enormous amount of time. I'm not the genius, but you see the people who are successful. They apply themselves a lot of time. And you have to be careful to find something that it adds value, okay? And adding value, it's different for different people. One person may be a plumber, and they add value that way, and they create the life, and that's not a problem, okay? Somebody else may be an inventor or entrepreneur, and they create the next big high-tech company and make billions and billions of dollars. But you have to add value. Then I would say you have to study a lot, because we know a lot now, and there's other people who are competing in that respect. And in order to study a lot, you have to know how to learn, okay? And then as markets change and conditions change and new things emerge, you have to learn how to learn quickly because we're all growing older. We're not growing younger. So you have to learn how to learn quickly. And you always have to have a problem-solving attitude, because if you approach things with a problem-solving attitude, well, either you can solve the problem or you can't. But, you know, so with those, I think with that approach to life and with a little bit of wisdom of knowing what problems you can solve and what problems you can't solve, right, and then you have to find your serenity with those that you cannot solve. You have to live with that, right. Okay? Then I think you're setting yourself for success in the sense that you create optionality for yourself and you'll get a lucky break, because life gives you the lucky breaks if you do all the above. So it's basically hard work and being organized and disciplined.
So what do you think you wish you knew 25 years ago versus today?
Yeah, so that's a good question. That I would say that I wish I knew everything that I know today and nothing that I know today. And what do I mean by that? Theoretically, with everything that I know today, I am properly better positioned to make some decisions as we go, the decisions that we make every day. However, that's a bit of a mirage. Okay, it's a bit of a misnomer. Because when you are younger, what you have, and the greatest attribute of youth is the innocence. So you're making decisions in innocence, okay? And that has a tremendous amount of value, okay? Because that is how you learn. So it's the corollary of having the experience. So the fact is, it's very, very, I mean, this is one of the major anthropological decisions. There is a very famous writer, Gregory Bateson, who wrote about this and has written very, very beautifully about it. So that's why my answer is, it's a very hard thing to answer. It's nothing, everything and nothing, okay? Now, you learn some things, right, along the way. You learn how to, I wish I was better at discovering the Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns and at blind spots, because we all have blind spots. If you can sort of overcome those, that you'll do well. And sometimes, you know, trusting people, because that's where some of the big disappointments come from. But nevertheless, it's still everything and nothing is the answer.
So how have you, everyone has setbacks as an entrepreneur or a PE person or anybody who invests. How have you handled those?
Well, in the beginning, I used to take it very personally, okay, and internalize it. Then you realize that that's not necessarily terribly healthy, okay? And you have to basically have conviction in what you do. If you have a good value system and you always return to your value system, you have your conviction is high, and you know you're doing the right thing, that you'll overcome the setbacks. It's they are not. Now, the thing is, you have to be careful about what is a setback, right?
Right.
Okay. Because a setback of the day-to-day setbacks, we all have. We have setbacks every day and we have some breaks every day. But when you're looking now in the business that you and I are in, asset management at large, you have to make sure that the setback doesn't take you out, okay? Because if it takes you out, then you don't live to fight another day.
That is so true.
So you have to read a little bit in portfolio theory,
yeah,
and make sure that you don't have investments that are so outsized in terms of risk that they can take down the whole edifice. Okay. So, and as we grow older and we learn that more and more, we realize what the barbell strategies are, where you have the large majority of your investments paying the bills and returning the capital and so on and so forth. And then you have some smaller size of those investments, so smaller allocation that will give you the outsized returns. And as you grow older, you do that more because you've learned that lesson. That's why Wall Street is not for heroes in asset management.
Right, for longevity. If you want to stay in there for a long time.
If you're managing portfolios, you're managing capital, you want to stay there because the market always comes back. I mean, how many times have we seen it? You and I, how many cycles of have we been through? Okay, and it comes back, and it comes back in a slightly different way, and or a very bit different way, and there's always new massive opportunities. Okay, and you have to be there to take advantage of them. So
your conclusion is, you the ability to take risks, but then to manage the size of the risks that you're taking.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really important. So back to water, the water infrastructure in the U.S., I remember doing a paper 15 years ago, and I think the capital that was needed was $600 billion to repair the water infrastructure. Is that a...
It's some hundreds of billions.
Right.
The U.S. Corps of Engineers does a report, I think, every 3 years.
Right.
And they come up with $600 billion, $1 trillion. I mean, the numbers are enormous. And they are certainly bigger than what is available to invest in the water infrastructure now. And most importantly, we continue to have a funding gap because water infrastructure is not... Okay. So what's the driver for water infrastructure? It's population growth, okay? So I'm not from the United States, I'm from Greece originally, but when you allow your infrastructure to depreciate without proper refurbishment and maintenance, okay, then that means you have to rebuild that infrastructure. And then you also have to build a new infrastructure, okay, for the population growth. So the needs are phenomenal, and every year we're falling behind because we're underfunding the aggregate investment that needs to go both in refurbishment as well as in new infrastructure that has to be built. Now, the only good news is that if you actually look at the long-term trends and you look at investment in water, freshwater infrastructure and wastewater infrastructure, interestingly, they have both doubled since 2020. So if you look at the 15 years prior to 2020, and you look at the 5 years since 2020, in those years, it has crept up. Now, if you compress this in a logarithmic, it's actually what you would call in technical terms a breakout. Okay,
breakouts.
Yeah, and it is a breakout. And I think to some degree, okay, important degree, it's related to COVID. Because when people went home, worried about the air quality, they also were worried about water quality. And I think there was a societal change, okay, that actually now brings more attention to quality of water, which is great.
So who's going to pay for it? Is it private, public, or private, or mostly public? How do you see it going forward?
So in the United States, there's a lot of people who can pay for it. Okay, in the United States, water infrastructure historically has been publicly owned, primarily municipalities. The municipal bond market, the predecessor of the municipal bond market, which was created in the 1890s when the cities of London in the UK, Boston, and New York realized that they have to have a proper sewer system, which they didn't have at the time. So you had waterborne disease at all-time highs. You had something like 100 waterborne diseases at the time, which basically kill you. And in different ways, it was mandated to create water infrastructure. That's when the New York Water Company was created, which created the sewers in New York, which eventually made so much money and had so much excess capital that it became the Chase Bank. So the Chase Bank was actually the water utility of New York.
Really?
Before it was the Chase Bank, yeah.
I've never heard of that one. Yeah. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. And then that started us on the municipal bond market. And the municipal bond market was primarily created to issue bonds to build sewers and water facilities and water infrastructure. That's why if you look at municipal balance sheets, on the average, they have 50%, 60% of their assets are in water assets, water infrastructure assets. So now going forward, who's going to pay for it? The laws in the United States are very favorable to utilities. Okay, if you own a utility, a regulated utility, and you build it, the regulators will award you a return, a guaranteed return. That's a great business model. Okay, it can be up to 10% net income after depreciation, after state and federal taxes. That's great. Okay, but someone needs to do it, and it's a hard thing to get up and running. So if you own a utility, it's great. If you own pipelines, it's great. These are great businesses. If you own treatment facilities, these are great businesses. When we look at water infrastructure, we have to look at different aspects of it. So there are dams, okay, which are equally important because they control floods, which are the biggest environmental disasters in the world. Then you have utilities that bring fresh water and treat wastewater, okay? And those are easier to own by private ownership. Although in the U.S., the utilities in private ownership are 15%, and 85% is municipal and other quasi-governmental entities and so on and so forth. And then you have the whole industry that supports the hydrocarbon cycle, which are the treatment facilities, the companies that make the treatment facilities, the filters, the pipes and all that. That's primarily private ownership. So you'll see the money going in that proportion into water infrastructure.
Wow. So the breakout, you expect the expenditure to continue doubling over the next 5 years?
I wish it does, because that's going to be very good for our businesses. I don't know if it's going to double, because that's a geometric increase that is quite substantial. To put it in perspective, even if it were to double, it would still be a fraction of what's needed. So we would still be underfunding.
Wow. So there's significant opportunities in water.
Yeah. It's in the tens of billions a year.
What about materials that they use to filter water now?
So there are a lot of technologies for filtering, and there can be different types of filtering. And it depends on the level of complexity of the water that you're treating. So if you're treating, let's say, very simple residential discharge water, okay, that's usually benign, fairly benign, and it's a very simple process. If you go to the other hand, to the other end, and I'm not going to talk about nuclear, but if you go to the other end and say, let's say you're treating dairy products or a cheese factory or a yogurt factory, or then because of the biological agents that they use for the production of cheese and dairy and so on and so forth and yogurt, the water that comes out is very toxic and needs to be treated. So there, the treatment process is much more involved. So there's always new inventions, new materials, because the magic in treatment, okay, is that remembering that water is different everywhere. So the chemistry of this location is different than the other location.
Is that why they say in New York you have better bagels than other places, because the water here is better or harder?
Yeah, New York has done an extremely good job with its water, which I can comment on that if you wish. But just to finish on the treatment, so the treatment different in every place, okay? And you use new materials, what's most important, the material is important, okay? But what's more important is the systems integration, is how do you bring everything together, all these materials, to treat water better, more economically, better life cycle costs, and so on and so forth. I'll give you a simple example. So if you use filters that involve plastics that have microparticles, now you're going to have to treat them for PFAS. So your filter is generating PFAS. That's, you know, law of unintended consequences. Okay. Now there are new filters that use ceramic materials. And the ceramic materials obviously don't have PFAS. Okay. So what's very interesting from a historical standpoint is that ceramic materials is what all the ancients, medievals, and everybody, all our predecessors used, because it lasted forever and it was a good conduit to create primitive to us water infrastructure, but highly engineered for them. Okay, and now we're going back to the same thing. So yes, there are always new materials coming down the pike, always new innovations, always new ideas. But the biggest issue is, how do you put it all together? Now, as it relates to New York, New York is very lucky.
I heard we have the best aqua filters.
So in New York, in the early on, 1700s, 1800s, it was growing very fast. Okay. And they needed to sort of bring water resources to support the city. Okay. The now Manhattan doesn't have any water resources other than what it rains. Okay, so they needed to bring water from upstate New York, and the first was the Croton Aqueduct, which is 125 miles from upstate New York. So similar story with Rome and Constantinople. It comes from up there. Now there are two more aqueducts that they have built. These are giant aqueducts that bring all the water down. So that's why we have a very good water resources. And yes, the water management in New York City has been one of the best in the world. And interestingly, what has also been a paradigm shift in terms of treating the environment, the way they have done the concessions and they treat the environment in upstate New York by buying all the land and preserving it and so on and so forth, where they take the water from the water table there, has been exemplary. So New York gets very, 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 very high grades on that. In fact, it gets such high grades that some of our wives don't think that what you have to pay for, they think it's for free because it comes out of the tap.
In New York City, okay? Yes.
In New York City. And then when you go and talk to people and say, well, do you know what the water is? But inside thing is free. Yeah. Okay, it's not free. We pay for it, but it's the conveyance system is a highly sophisticated. The only problem that we're having in New York is because when you build new neighborhoods and so on and so forth, sometimes you have sediment from the construction in the initial stages coming into your water pipes, and that goes away with time.
Right. Let's talk about something that water is not well liked for, is floods. Like, what was the biggest flood? What was the most amount of people ever killed in a flood?
So the biggest environmental disaster in the world is 1931, Yangtze River, okay? And 3.7 million people died.
From one flood?
From one flood, okay? Now, this was a horrible time for China because there had been the Japanese invasion. They were fighting the invaders, and they had this flood. And that's why Chairman Mao was dreaming that the Wushuan Mountains should keep the clouds up and not drain, so that until we build the dam, and they build the Three Gorges Dam a couple of decades later, or not more than a couple of decades later, but they started early on, and now it's the biggest dam in the world. But in China they have tremendous floods. They are completely dependent on the Yellow River and on the Yangtze River, both originate in the Tibet. And now you see the geopolitics in water. It has nothing to do with the reason that they want to control Tibet is to control the headwaters of the two rivers, because they are completely dependent on that. And actually, another interesting thing about China is that the biggest infrastructure in the world, the biggest piece of infrastructure, unified infrastructure in the world, and that you can also see from the moon, it's not the Chinese wall, okay? It's the central canal that has been built from the Yangtze to the Yellow, because the Yangtze River has 15 times the flow of the Yellow, but the Yellow has all the silt that is used for agriculture and makes the soil rich. So they wanted to connect them. So that took hundreds of years, and it's still operating, and it's still central to their existence.
Wow. So on another note, how did the... Because I know you're from Greece and probably study philosophy. How did the ancient philosophers, how did they view water?
Well, as Pausanias said, the travel writer, or he invented travel writing, he said a city is not a city unless it has fresh water centrally for its citizens. So it shows you the awareness of the need for fresh water, clean water in ancient times. And then they were ingenious in terms of bringing water to, again, the incline and, right. And how you clean it and so on and so forth. There are many different examples. The most famous one being on the island of Samos, where they have the most incredible aqueduct that is also not only an aqueduct that's the perfect incline. It comes from the mountain into the city and all that. But it's also protected from the elements, and it's protected from the enemies, so they cannot poison your water. So it's closed. It's enclosed. It's really worthwhile visiting.
Is that a real threat?
Yeah.
Contamination of the water system?
Absolutely.
How do they prevent that?
Well, sensors. You sense at all times what the chemicals are in your water. In we have built, as part of our business, what is now the sixth largest pure play water utility in the United States. We did that solely through acquisition over 6 years. And I can tell you that the sensors are central to managing on a real-time basis, because the sensor basically emits the data on a wireless basis to your computers, and you can control it. And you can see on your iPhone, if you're the manager, what the composition of water is at any time. So that's real-time management is really important. Some of the stuff that you hear about the Russians taking over or the enemy, whoever the enemy is, taking over, and that's very difficult to do. And the other thing, remember, water is local, as we were saying before.
Right.
So if you poison and you have to chemically poison a water table that belongs to city A, well, the city next door is not going to be poisoned. Okay. So it's because they're not connected. So it's very difficult. It's possible, but it's very difficult to do. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be vigilant and watching the chemical compositions at all times.
So one of the questions that I get asked a lot is the Arctic shelf melting? What is that going to be impact? Are we going to have mass floods? Obviously, the insurance companies think that because premiums down on the coast have really gone up significantly.
Yeah, the climate change subject is a big subject. A subset of climate change is temperatures rising. Okay, so in geological time, okay, and I'll speak about hard time also. In geological time, the impact of temperature comes from how much radiation does the Earth absorb. Okay, and that varies by the speed at which it's spinning, the tilt, the wobble. You know, there's all kinds of, there are five different measures by which how the Earth revolves. And according to that, the eccentricity, in other words, how far off center you are, because other stars are pulling you with their gravitational pull and so on and so forth. So
it sounds like the stock market a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit like the stock market. So the most important is how much radiation we absorb from the sun. The second most important is the currents, you know, La Niña, El Niño, okay? And the third most important is emissions from eruptions of volcanoes. And they go down massive step. In other words, the eruptions from volcanoes are way, way, way less than the sun. So then you say, okay, what's happening to the environment? What's happening? Is more radiation coming in, okay? And in geological time, you have the Milankovitch cycles. Those are the 40 years, 70 years, 130 years. Things change all the time, and you always have different types of the cycle. Now, in our time, okay, it's somewhat evident that there's been an unusual addition to the increase in temperature that perhaps is not explained by the geological time cycles, and that's possibly, I'm saying possibly, because nothing has been proven yet. It's all circumstantial evidence, but it's real. Okay, we can feel that the higher temperatures. And we can see in the Arctic, the water melting and so on and so forth. So that's a real thing. Now, that has real impact, because if the water in the oceans has higher temperature, that means it evaporates more and more quickly. And that means you have more precipitation. So you have an acceleration in the cycle of evaporation and precipitation. That's why you're getting all these, they call them 100-year storms, yeah. And then you get the flood. And then next year, you get another 100 years. But if it's every year, it's not 100 years. Okay. So basically, we are seeing that happen right now. There's no question about it.
Got it. So I should probably own some more insurance stocks.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, it depends on which side.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you so much. It's been very, very interesting and enlightening. It's just amazing to me how water is really underappreciated a lot of times, but it touches across everything that you do in your life. Thank you very much for coming.
It does. Well, I thank you for being here. Let me close with one quick statement.
Yeah.
For every century, other than 20th century, water has been the main commodity that people fight over.
Right.
Only in the 20th century, we fought over hydrocarbons.
Right.
So the 21st century is still out. We'll see what's the most important commodity in the 21st century.
All right.
Maybe water.
Thank you very much, John.
I thank you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.